Thank you for listening to the Damage Report podcast, the show covering the true threats facing our country and what you can actually do about them. You can support this free podcast by leaving us a review and giving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you happen to be listening to it. Every review helps more people discover the show at no cost to you. Welcome back to the Damage Report, everybody. I'm John Iderola. We've got a big show. Two guests joining us by Skype a little bit later on. We're going to be talking about the initiative by some, including funding from the restaurant industry, to overturn a DC voter initiative to allow tipped workers to actually make the effective minimum wage. We'll be talking about that. And also a little bit in terms of how you can prepare for things like hurricanes in a time when there's all these disasters. What can you actually do to be ready? We'll be joined by a guest to talk about that. But obviously there's, a huge amount of news of the day, as there always is. Ben Mankiewicz is in studio to break that down with us.
John, it's good to be here. I came on this show when it was on an hour earlier with another host, and I'm glad to see they made a change, and I think you'll do great.
I think in the new time
slot. It just
slot.
Didn't seem like that guy, I don't know, he didn't, it's not so much that he didn't know what was going on, but that's sort of what it is. He didn't know what was going
on.
So
sometimes you can not know, but charisma can carry
that's
you
right.
through.
That's right, he had neither.
But
that's right.
No,
that's
and
right.
you can't really, not, and no name.
Anyway, good luck.
Doesn't come from anywhere.
Pleased to see
so,
you got this
thank
game.
You. Okay, we are the worst. Okay. So, look, there's a lot to talk about. We're going to be talking about the latest on Brett Kavanaugh, the continuing developing scandal around his alleged sexual assault back in the 80s. We're going to take a bit of a wider look at the Supreme Court, with some people talking about a way that it could be reformulated to bring it perhaps more in line with the way politics operates in the modern era. And then Donald Trump is getting more involved with the actual running of the Mueller investigation than he perhaps ever has. We'll
thank
be talking
goodness.
About the, thank God, he's finally taking the reins on that one. We'll be breaking that down as well. But first, Kavanaugh. So perhaps the most important part of what's developed since our show yesterday is that we might actually have an open hearing testimony from both Brett Kavanaugh about the allegations and also from Christine Blasey Ford, who is making the allegations. Both Kavanaugh and the woman who accused him will apparently be testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee next Monday. That was the news as of last night. As of this morning, Chuck Grassley is saying that there is the possibility that Christine Blasey Ford might back out or hasn't yet accepted it, even though it seemed pretty clear that she had before.
Yeah, this was new news from Grassley saying that it's not, she hasn't confirmed.
Mm-hmm. And look, if she doesn't do it, there's any number of different reasons that might be. We know from the beginning that she did not want to be an out front part of this. She brought forward the allegations. She didn't want her name to be out there. And if the reason is that she had this crazy idea that she would be attacked, and it turned out that's exactly what happened, she has been smeared in every way a person could be smeared. Many of the Fox hosts, their whole focus is on who's paying her to do this. There's no allegations of that. There's no evidence that she's being paid. She has a professorship. She stands to lose so much by coming out about this, but they continually present the accuser as someone who is attempting to gain fame or fortune. Are there examples of that?
Yeah, Tammy Lahren said that's not her name.
It's close enough.
What is her name?
Tommy Lahren.
She said
Lahren.
Tommy Lahren. Tommy
yeah.
Lahren said that, she was like, oh, she comes out at the last second, opportunity. And like, what's the opportunity? What opportunity is this to, I tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to throw my name into the ringer. I'm going to have half the country chew me up. I'm going to and accuse me of attempting at the last minute to undermine the reputation of this great and noble man. I'm going to have people call me the worst names you can call a woman in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone's going to throw my name in the headlines and talk about how awful and terrible I am. And the upside of this is really nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing at all.
Specific to her, at
right.
the very least.
She has a good job, a good life, right? So none of that makes any sense. The only thing that makes sense is she thought this was important. It doesn't make what she said true, mm-hmm. right? Maybe she's misremembering it. Maybe she was drunk too. All things that are worth asking her about in an open setting. But nobody does this because they think it's some great winning advantage which will help them. That is just, that's inconceivable. And that's really the most common attack on her.
And the thing is, look, yes, she might be looking back to historical precedent and think, well, everything went so splendidly for Anita Hill, I want me some of that.
Right.
Maybe But not everybody gets to be Anita. Obviously, it's ridiculous. Here's what I want you to do. Hopefully, you've been doing this already. But if not, feel free to do it through the rest of this week as more and more of these attacks come out. When a new piece of news comes out about Christine Blasey Ford, I want you to process it and then immediately ask the question, does this have anything to do with whether or not she was sexually assaulted in the 80s? I think that's a great experiment. In fact, I'm going to give you an example of that right now. So Laura Ingraham, journalist Laura Ingraham, tweeted, accuser Christine Ford's parents were defendants in a 1996 foreclosure case presided over by Kavanaugh's mother. Well, first of all, before we actually get to the truth of that, okay. Second thought, does this have anything to do with whether she was actually sexually assaulted in the 80s? No, it has nothing to do with it. It's a really weird thing to bring up. And it turns out that it's not actually true, as CNN's John King eventually covered on Inside Politics. The case was dismissed before the judge had to ever rule on it, and the property is still in the family's name. So if this is supposed to be the motivation for her to, 2 decades later, attempt to take down that judge's son, it seems a little bit odd to have a vendetta when nothing bad happened to your family. That's not usually, you know more about these classic plots in movies. That's not usually how a revenge plot starts.
The only thing that's relevant here, I mean, of course, it's true that this is how she remembers it. The only thing is there are 2 issues, I think, just 2 issues. How well does she remember it? How well can we trust her memory? That's a totally reasonable thing to ask. And if it is true, is that enough to disqualify Judge Kavanaugh from the Supreme Court?
Yeah.
Or if enough of it is believed to be true, if she's credible enough. She told people at the time. She's told people since then.
She talked about it in 2012.
She talked about it in 2017 when a friend of hers came out with a Me Too story about being attacked in high school. And then she sent her a letter saying, you know what, this rang true to me. The same thing happened to me.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, it seems obviously that this is her memory of it. And so she should be heard.
Yeah.
It's obvious.
Yeah. Now, you might also hear going around if you follow the wrong people on Twitter. We talked yesterday about the fact that she apparently donated like $5 or $10 to the DCCC, I think, and to Friends of Bernie. I think she gave $30. That's all true.
Who gives $30 to Bernie?
It's probably 27.
It's probably 27. Yeah, right.
But follow-up question, does that have anything to do with whether she was sexually assaulted or not in the 80s? No.
No, but it's
also, but did you know that she signed on to a letter where she was mad at Donald Trump for his border policy?
Yeah, right. So,
and does that have anything to do with whether she was sexually assaulted or not in the 80s?
Well, what is relevant is that this is, of course, why people don't come forward, because then every little activity, I mean, of course, she's a what kind of professor is she?
I'm not actually sure. My gut says psychology, but I'm not sure.
So she's a person of some repute, and she is distinguished and educated, and people who are distinguished and educated, I mean, many people, but it is not a surprise that she would be.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called Un-F-ing the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of Un-F-ing the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
you must unlearn what you have learned.
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today, and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Moderately active in the political world and aware of the events around her and take on an opinion. I would like to point out to all those who are instantly running to defend Judge Kavanaugh on this that many of the women who co-accused Judge Roy Moore were conservatives. Right. There was no they hadn't given $27 to Bernie. So the point is but they still attacked them, too.
Yeah.
So you will you find anything, as opposed to just saying, oh, this is disappointing news about a guy I liked. Mm-hmm. And if we can't get him through with when all you need is 50 votes in the United States Senate, then maybe he shouldn't be the nominee. But you'll probably get it anyway. But again, just be honest about your objection to him. You know, if you read carefully enough, you find enough Republicans out there who say, hey, we should have a hearing. And anyway, look, they rammed this through anyhow. We don't have access to, hundreds of thousands of documents that have been available in under the almost every recent other nominee.
Yeah. Yeah. And so look, someone's previous political activity, unless it's in being involved in other conspiracies, doesn't have anything to do with
also,
this.
But if you, sorry, John, but it just occurred to me. If you were going to, so their recent activities. So if we were going to, if their idea is, no, this is an effort by the left to undermine Brett Kavanaugh, and I hope the left undermines Brett Kavanaugh, right? Mm-hmm. I want anyone to undermine Brett Kavanaugh. I want this delayed enough so the Democrats win the Senate, mm-hmm. and it changes the nature of who goes on the Supreme Court. I think that's critically important for the future of the country. But again, like with the deep state, who couldn't have screwed this up more, mm-hmm. right? If you were going to find someone to make a last-second allegation against Brett Kavanaugh and you were going to concoct it out of whole cloth, you were going to take something that didn't exist and make it, I wouldn't pick that when he was 17 and drunk, he attacked somebody.
Yeah.
I mean, it is a very long time ago, which means his life after that will take import to some people, and they will say, well, he's led a distinguished life since then. And just the nature of the memory means that the memory is much more easily impeached.
Yeah.
It's a terrible deep state plan to go after, if that was the whole idea.
And even if you were going to do that, and she was going to make this up, would she put an accomplice in the room with him? Mark Judge is the alleged accomplice. Would she have a witness who could come forward and say that it happened or didn't happen? If it didn't happen, she wouldn't do that. That's
it's
the sort of thing you do.
It's obvious that her memory is her memory and that is what she believes to be true. That is unquestioned. She's not making this up. Mm-hmm. Whether it happened the way she remembers it, you know, we're probably never going to totally know.
Yeah. Well, and one other thing I want to mention is a lot of people are saying the defense is that this just happened in high school. Are we going to judge people based on the things that happened in high school? My standard is if it's about sexual assault, yes, we will. But even if you don't believe that we should, this is not just about something that happened in high school. If it happened, he's lying about it now. He wasn't lying about it when he was a kid. He's a full-grown adult lying about a sexual assault. So this is no longer about behavior that just took place in high school. This is behavior that took place up to and including the time I'm spending saying this sentence. So let's dispense with that talking point as well.
If we judged only what we did in high school as to how we see people now in their 30s, 40s, or 50s, I would be doing infinitely better in life.
Really?
I crushed it in high school. I was awesome. I was popular. I was hilarious. Everything I did was fantastic in high school. It's been a steady 33-year decline since high school.
Your hair is still pretty good.
Yeah, fair point.
Yeah, no, I was not good in high school, by the way. I was a waste of potential is how it was usually termed to my parents in conversations I could overhear. And many people will agree that that has continued until now. One other comment, by the way, in terms of judging someone based on something that happened in high school, the New York Times' Barry Weiss says, you know, aside from this one moment, his reputation is pretty great, which is an amazing thing that you can, of course, do other examples with. Like, you know, OJ, other than the one time. But anyway, she's getting paid a lot. She's reputable, works for the New York Times. I'm just some schmo on YouTube TV. Anyway, we do have to take a quick break, but when we come back, more on potentially the future of the Supreme Court, both with Kavanaugh and in a wider sense after this. I think we're all aware that in the vast majority of the country, people who make tips as a significant portion of their income, you know, bartenders, servers, things like that, are paid in general an hourly wage that's far lower than other people, below the actual minimum wage. So DC took it upon themselves to pass a law to actually change that, but that itself might not last. And joining us now on the Damage Report is Mike Tanglis, senior researcher for Public Citizens Congress Watch, to break down this challenge to that law. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I'm glad to have you here. So you've been doing a lot of work around this Initiative 77, this ongoing battle. Can you break down how that's actually playing out?
So in June of this year, the voters in D.C. passed a ballot measure, Initiative 77, that will eventually abolish the lower tipped minimum wage for tipped workers. So as it stands right now, regular workers for the minimum wage is $13.25 an hour, but for tipped workers, it's $3.89. And so over an 8-year period, what will happen is the tipped minimum wage will gradually increase until it hits $15 by 2026. And at that point, the regular minimum wage will also be $15, and therefore abolishing the tip minimum wage. Now, what happened was when this first got on the ballot, the restaurant industry mobilized very aggressively to try to, you know, stop this from passing. They started a few different committees that raised hundreds of thousands of dollars to sort of cover the district with signs, misleading the public really about what the initiative would do. Regardless of all that, it actually passed. It passed with 56% of the vote. 44,000, more than 44,000 voters in the district approved it. And what was interesting about that was immediately, as in the first night, the night that it passed, there was already talk of repeal. The restaurant industry was lobbying council members. Council members were already implying essentially that they were going to repeal it. And it looks like now, after 7 council members introduced a bill for a full repeal, that they actually will repeal it fairly soon. And what we did was we took a look at the campaign contributions that these entities and restaurant owners who are opposed to the initiative, how much money they had given to these politicians over their past 2 elections.
And I assume that was significant.
Yeah, so what it was is we went through and we looked at all the restaurants and corporations, because it's important to note here in D.C., corporations and LLCs can contribute directly to candidates. And we found that over their past 2 elections, the 14 elected officials who ultimately decided the fate of the initiative, 13 council members and Mayor Bowser, had received $236,000 from these entities opposed to the initiative. In 2018 alone, these entities have given more than $80,000. 80% of that has gone to 2 people, Chairman Phil Mendelson and Mayor Bowser, who are the ones who really ultimately decide the fate, as they have the most power. The one other thing, go ahead.
I'm just curious, because it seems so relevant, because the instinct for everybody who's gone to a restaurant and tipped is that restaurant goers, patrons, will eventually in 8 years stop tipping. And so now maybe that won't happen. I'm not, and of course, we can't be sure, but how do waiters feel about this? Is this good for restaurant workers or not, regardless of the obvious attempt by the restaurant industry to influence the vote?
Sure. To the first point, though, the committee created by the restaurant industry to oppose the measure is called Save Our Tips Initiative 77. Huh. The obvious implication there is if this initiative passes, tipping is gone. But the truth is that's actually not the case. Currently, 8 states have abolished or do not have a lower tip minimum wage. And in all of those states, people still tip. I mean, tipping itself is nothing. It's not something that's required by law. We all tip 20% or more because that's sort of what we're accustomed to. But there's nothing forcing us to do that. To your other question about servers and bartenders in the industry, they had a hearing yesterday where many came out opposed to the initiative. And the truth is, it's mixed, right? So the restaurant industry itself is opposed to it. So if you're an employee who does not like it, you feel pretty free about speaking up. If you're for it and your owner has covered your establishment with signs opposing it, you're not going to feel that comfortable. So there are many that oppose. There are many that are for it. But it's also important to mention that it's not just servers and bartenders. It also includes nail salon workers, parking lot attendants, pizza delivery drivers. So a lot of people who may not feel that comfortable about speaking up and saying, hey, I actually, you know, support this initiative.
We talk a lot on the show about how money can influence the way that legislators actually act, what bills get passed and what don't. But this seems like a particularly egregious example, because this is direct democracy in terms of passing this ballot initiative that seems to be pretty casually being set aside by the elected officials. Is there any expectation or possibility that those council members will face any pushback or possibly removal or anything like that as a result of this action they're taking?
It's a great question. So actually what first got us into this research, we didn't really start until after the initiative was approved, because it just seemed so crazy to see, you know, many council members say, yeah, we're going to go ahead and do away with this, just days after, you know, all these people came out in the district and voted for it. In terms of backlash, it will be interesting to see. You know, there are 11 of the 13 council members before the initiative passed actually came out and said that they weren't for it. But right now, only 7 have signed on to repeal. So there's definitely something that some of the council members are feeling. A few of them have been quoted in the press saying, listen, I was against this, but, you know, the people had a say, and it's pretty clear. And as you alluded to in your question, it's for most part, voters don't get to have any input on policy besides if they're lobbying or talking to their officials. But this is a pretty clear sign where a policy was presented to the public and the public said, yes, we want this. And within 3 weeks, half the council has signed on and said, we're going to do away with it completely, which is really crazy to think about.
Yeah, and I certainly hope that there are consequences coming, as this seems like a pretty bold attempt to override what the people actually want. Well, Mike Tinglis, thank you so much for joining the show.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, the future of the Supreme Court and Brett Kavanaugh's nomination. How will Monday's proceedings actually affect it? So, unless Christine Blasey Ford does not actually agree to what we think will be Monday's testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee, we will actually hear the stories from both her and from Brett Kavanaugh. Now, one additional wrinkle to this came out just in advance of today's show when Senator Susan Collins tweeted that she wants counsel for Professor Ford to be allocated time to question Kavanaugh and counsel for Kavanaugh time to question Ford. So not just testimony, but now sort of cross-examination, I guess. I don't watch a lot of procedurals, but do you think that that might complicate things?
I
imagine that the counsel will go pretty hard against Ford.
Susan Collins is such a colossal disappointment to humanity that I don't trust her motives. You know, instinctively, you're like, well, if they both get to cross-examine, okay, right? You know, you want they have one opportunity to try and learn something here. It seems good that the lawyers might, in cross-examine, be able to glean some important information. But I just simply don't trust Susan Collins, or I don't think Susan Collins has a firm grasp of the American political system because of her, you know, well, I talked to Brett Kavanaugh, and he said it's established law.
Yeah.
You know, and you're like, hey, man, Susan, you heard of the Federalist Society? You know what they do, right?
Yeah.
You know how this pick came about? You think Donald Trump was up late at night pulling his hair out trying to pick the best judge he could for America? You know, or you think, hey, man, I think the president should get to nominate his pick, and if he overturns Roe versus Wade, well, that'll make me very sad, but I think the president's pick deserves to be approved.
Which seems to be what she actually thinks.
Seems to be, right.
She won't say that.
So it gets to the point where, the future of the Supreme Court, where I hope we end up after, at some point, is a total dispensing of these crazy, archaic notions about that no guy will answer about a certain case.
Yeah.
Like, let's...
Oh, they're all hypotheticals.
How do you feel about the death penalty? I don't approve of it. I will attempt to overturn it on the Supreme Court. Yeah. I think the law is wrong. I think Roe versus Wade should be overturned, or I think Roe versus Wade should be the law of the land. And if Congress won't do it, then it's up to the courts to protect the right of a woman to have an abortion. I think it's built into the Constitution. Like, let's have those answers. Mm-hmm. Like, why have we, it's like the local news. We have intentionally decided to dumb ourselves down.
Yeah. To pretend insane things.
Like this, Roe versus Wade is among the 3 or 4 most critical issues facing the court going forward, arguably first. Why can't you give an answer on it?
Yeah.
You know, and first of all, by the way, you're a judge on the Supreme Court. If you change your mind, if it turns out you lied to Congress, you're fine. You still get to hang out for 46 years on the court doing grave damage to the country.
So much of American politics is just a game of pretend.
That's right. And
we
this
pretend,
is.
And everyone is acting in bad faith. Almost everyone.
And all it would take is a significant band of United States senators to say, if you don't tell me how you're going to vote on these issues, I'm not going to confirm you.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like
the reality caucus.
Right,
the reality caucus. Real.
Yeah, how you feel about Roe versus Wade? Okay, well, that's an outrage. You won't give me an answer. I'm voting no. I'm telling you right now because I believe you're going to overturn it.
Yeah, I'm not going to play Russian roulette with the Supreme Court.
Right, yeah.
How about that? And she obviously is okay with Roe v. Wade being overturned, even though she has stated any number of times that she isn't, Susan Collins, I'm saying. And so that should be acknowledged, too. So look, I want to open it up just a little bit because I saw it was a combination of two things. The last episode of John Oliver and an editorial in the New York Times about this. And by the way, John Oliver, God, he just won the Emmy. That show is just amazing. And by the way, Dan of the Control Room, very funny too. Oh, no, you're right there. He's very funny as well. But anyway, he did something about the Supreme Court and how, I mean, we were just sort of talking about this, how bizarre and anachronistic the process of selecting Supreme Court justices is, that it's a real crapshoot. If they'll die during your term or retire, then you get zero or one or possibly nine. They have to pretend not to have ever thought about anything political in their entire life, and then you just ram it through. It's a very bizarre political way of doing this. And then they end up with lifetime appointments, which apparently no other high court in any country in the world actually has lifetime appointments for reasons that seem pretty clear when you actually think about it. So people are starting to talk about the possibility of changing that process. And one thing that in both this editorial and John Oliver brought up is a possibility of having something like 18-year staggered terms on the court, where every four-year presidential term would have two nominations to the Supreme Court, so that you would no longer have one person potentially gets all or nothing. Every president would have some ability to reshape the court, and it would more closely track with politics in a changing country.
Clarence Thomas resigned. Donald Trump, under the threat of impeachment, perhaps indictment for many of those close to him. We've already seen potentially family members indicted, might get three Supreme Court nominees in 2 years, 2.5 years. Barack Obama served 8 years, popularly elected with more votes than Trump each time, got two.
Sort of three, but two.
Right, but no, of course, two. By the way, a little bit of breaking news. Apparently, Christine Blasey Ford told CNN this morning, I'll be testifying.
Good.
This is Jonathan Chait writing in the New York Magazine that this was a attempt by the Republicans to sort of bluff her out of it.
Okay. Well, I'm glad that she's actually going through with it. So what do you think about this or a similar proposal? Should we rethink the Supreme Court?
I unquestionably think we should rethink the Supreme Court. I don't know if that's right, but I mean, just like we should rethink the Electoral College. There are things that we did in 1789 that seem silly now. And to all those people, who've responded to me and to others that, no, it protects the small. It's not what's happening. It's not what that is about. There's some argument that we should rethink the United States Senate, right? We give tremendously undue power to very, very few people. And in this case, we've given it to the most rural and the whitest people in the country, who, like, 70 Senate seats will, I don't know if it's 2040, something like that, that 70% of the United States Senate will belong to 30% of the population.
A number that I think is growing more unequal over time.
That's right. Yeah, it's headed in that direction.
Yeah.
So maybe this is a good solution, but as long as you don't have to change the Constitution to do it, do you have to change the
Constitution? I believe you have to change the Constitution to do it.
Well, the great thing about the Electoral College is that you wouldn't necessarily have to change the Constitution. You just need 270 votes worth of states to sign on to the National Popular Vote Consortium. I think they're either at 172 or 181 right now.
And I believe so far every one of those is a traditionally blue state, which perhaps is not shocking.
I don't know. Maybe that's true. I don't know. Yeah, look at that.
We've talked about it before. It might have changed since then.
But one of the problems is that, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Florida, Michigan, Wisconsin, none of those swing states that get all that ad money and all that attention. And even if you're less cynical, and it's not the ad money, but it's just attention from candidates every 4 years, they have no interest in this because the election is sort of decided in those states, and they like that.
Yeah, I'm sure that they do. It seems terrible.
Right, but we're not electing a president of Wisconsin and Florida.
Exactly.
Right? We're also electing a president of Indiana
and Texas.
As
of right now,
Texas,
maybe we are.
California and New York. That's right.
Yeah. So it's a frustrating system, obviously. I find the Supreme Court, these ideas for reform of it, very fascinating. I haven't yet heard strong counter proposals to this about why that might be a bad idea. None immediately leap to mind, but I do want to think about it a little bit more. These are the sorts of things that we should be willing to consider because it's a disaster right now. It will be for the rest of our life. It's never going to become less political. When it comes to the Electoral College, I mean, they were saying at the time, you're only talking about this because it just happened. Okay, well, it's been like 2 years. We're almost exactly at the midway point. If we are ever not too close to an election, we're about at the point where we're least too close to an election. Is everybody on cable news talking about getting rid of the Electoral College? No, nobody's talking about it. Of course, it's a stalling tactic, and we are being stalled. Okay, we are going to take a short break, though. But when we come back, Eitan Edwards is going to join us. Hurricane season is here. Lots to prepare for. He'll give us some advice. We are now in the thick of hurricane season, and so I'm very pleased to invite to the show Eitan Edwards, is the executive director of the International Preparedness Network, going to help us break down how we can be prepared for things like hurricanes. Eitan, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you guys for having me. I'm happy to be here today.
I'm glad to have you here. So Hurricane Florence, we're still in the aftermath of that, and it was a bad storm. It was a deadly storm. With things like that in the news, what do you recommend for people who are in areas that might be affected by things like hurricanes? What should they be thinking about long in advance of the disaster in terms of what they can do?
I think that one of the most important things in terms of dealing with the hurricanes is preparing for them, obviously, before they happen. Also having an exit plan pre-prepared, as opposed to kind of like making it up as you go along. I think that the American people are going to have to recognize to a large degree that because of the global warming and the situation, you know, as Trump calls it, the Chinese hoax, it's real. And we're going to have these superstorms that are going to increase in their frequency and magnitude over the next several decades, if not indefinitely. And we're going to have to take the measures for ourselves and do the things that we are going to have to do. We're going to have to make sure that we have emergency food. We're going to have to make sure we have emergency water. We're going to have to make sure we have exit plans. The people speak about the go bags, those pre-packed bags that you use that can allow for you to survive outside of your home for extended periods, usually about a week. And all of this has to be incorporated into our daily routine. We're going to have to learn that it's going to make it a lifestyle as opposed to something that we just do with, because this is going to increase. This is not going to go away. I think that in a lot of cases, people are trying to, oh, it's going to get better in time. No, it's not going to get any better. It's going to get worse, especially people who live in the low-lying areas, in the coastal areas. I've heard over the past summer that there are areas in the country that are actually flooding and there's no rainstorms. So we've got to recognize this truth. This is a reality in our existence today, and we got to plan for it.
You know, so you talk there about how the disasters are actually getting worse. I'm interested in the time that you've been, you know, doing talks about this, writing books and all of that. How has the idea or the popular perception of preparedness changed over time? Are people taking it more seriously?
Well, you know, they're taking it more seriously, John. But the thing is that they to a large degree, that the prepping became popular, the term prepping, as it kind of phased over from, let's say, survivalism to prepping. And but in the process of it being, I suppose, popularized and integrating itself into the culture, that in a lot of cases it got a little warped, and some people were not attracted to it anymore because they see it as kind of like people who are preppers are somewhat fanatical and a little bit too extreme. But in reality, I mean, there's more people that embrace it now than they did, like, let's say, 10, 20 years ago. But one of the things that I've been working on over the years is to try to get this into the mainstream culture. And that is for everyone to consider prepping to be something that's a part of their life, a part of their lifestyle. Everybody you've got car insurance, you've got insurance for your home, you go out in the rain, you need a raincoat. And prepping is that kind of a countermeasure to the things that we know are going to occur. So yes, people are responding to it more. You know, as in terms of better, I think that a lot of people are not attracted to the so-called prepping aspect of it because they think that there's something connected to it that's a little bit extreme, but that's not the truth. The reality is we've got to do it. It's something that we have to do.
What can I ask, what have you, I'm totally curious, since what have you done to prepare?
Well, I've done everything that I've got the emergency food, emergency water, emergency escape plan, the materials and equipment that I need to mitigate it, respond to and recover from a wide variety of disasters. And it's something that you do in periods of time. You take your time. You don't do it all at once. It can be a little expensive in that way. But what I've done is I've designed a program that is kind of a fast response to, let's say, the most frequent disasters that I encounter in my area. Like, I'm in New York, and so I've got a kit and I've got plans that I've conformed and designed to respond to the kind of disasters that we have here in New York. And that would include the nor'easters, the snowstorms, occasional hurricanes, And unfortunately, even a terroristic incident like we saw in 9/11 back in 2001. And a few things that are going to occur in the future, I think things that I'm most worried and most concerned about the American population, and that is a pandemic. And I've also taken measures to prepare for that as well. So I think that this is one of the most important things, and I wanted to speak to you guys about this and getting to your viewers, that we've got to start to prepare for these larger scale emergencies, that the government is not going to be able to help us, as we saw in Puerto Rico, as we still see in Puerto Rico.
And is there let me just interrupt, is there an affordable way to do this for folks?
Say again?
Is there
say
an
again?
Affordable way to do this for people?
Of course. It's all about, you know, I always say that if you've got a will, that there's a way. There are ways to do this where if you can't afford to buy, like, some of the equipment that can be expensive, a lot of it can be even improvised. I teach classes on how people can make things from scratch, finding stuff in the trash that you can convert into drip water filters and gas masks and all sorts of things that they can do to kind of, let's say, offset the costs. It's just about whether you have the will to learn how to do it. But if you do, there's always a way to get it done. And that's what I want people to understand. But also to understand that this is something that's imperative, especially relative to things like hurricanes and also, again, you know, not to belabor the point, but the pandemics. Because we're due for one, they come every 100 years or so. And there was something up at Johns Hopkins University in May. It was a CLADEX exercise where they had a number of professionals that came together to coordinate a drill, a simulated drill of what the governmental response would be for a large-scale pandemic. And I can tell you straight out that, generally speaking, we're not prepared as a nation to deal with these kinds of catastrophes. Again, as we saw in Puerto Rico, we weren't prepared. And then we don't have the leadership to kind of direct us in the ways that we need to when these things strike. So it's up to the American people to do the things that are necessary to protect themselves and to not look for the government to come and swoop down and fly in and make everything great, because they're not going to be able to do it. The responders are great, but the first responders need the American people to take responsibility for themselves and their own lives so that their jobs aren't going to be made more complicated when these disasters strike. And believe me, they are going to come.
Eitan Edwards, Executive Director of the International Preparedness Network, obviously timely advice, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
One last quick break. Donald Trump getting involved in the Mueller investigation in a whole new way. We'll break that down. Welcome back to the Damage Report. I would love to do this last segment on the Emmys, because that's all I want to talk about right now. But no, we're going to talk about declassification, the sexiest of the Asians. Donald Trump is getting more involved in this Mueller investigation by releasing information, significant amounts of information having to do with the investigation that is, of course, ongoing. So he primarily, the most important part is he ordered the declassification of parts of a previously secret warrant application to eavesdrop on Carter Page, one of his foreign policy advisors, who was flagged at one point by intelligence agencies as a target of Russian interest. Now, he wasn't the only one, but he was one of the significant ones. And from the very beginning, the origins of various parts of this investigation have been very much the focus of Donald Trump and his defenders in both the media and in politics. Again, like with Christine Blasey Ford, the actual content of the investigations, whether crimes were committed, doesn't even enter into the discussion. It's all about how this came about, which is a nice little evasion there. But it's not just that search warrant that's being declassified. You also have FBI reports on interviews concerning Page, interviews with Justice Department official Bruce Orr, as well as all of the text messages concerning the Russia probe by Orr and James Comey and his deputy Andrew McCabe. Now, I didn't see in this initial reporting Lisa Page and Strzok, but Donald Trump seemed to be implicating them as well in
tweets. No, the selection of documents reading from Slate here, Elliot Hannon's piece in Slate, the selection of documents includes unredacted text messages from former government officials Trump has pegged as mortal enemies, including FBI Director James Comey, Deputy Director Andrew McCabe, former FBI officials Peter Strzok and Lisa Page, as well as interviews with Justice Department official Bruce Orr. So there it is.
So what do you think about this new move?
I mean, it's a political move. The Trump's attempt to fight this is going to be political. It's going to be doubling down on the initial theory, but here attempting to, again, it is dishonest at its core. In the name of openness of government, mm-hmm. right? He is going to say that, look, this was an anti-Trump bias. Those three words are one hyphenated word. And is it three words?
I don't know.
Two and a half words.
It's one catchphrase.
Anti-Trump bias at the root of the investigation, at the very core of the investigation was this anti-Trump bias. I would counter that a little bit by calling it, yeah, that's right, we have an anti-criminal bias in the Justice Department. So when there's a criminal, we're anti the criminal, and we have a bias to try and get the criminal prosecuted in some way. So, but that's the phrase that will allow, you know, law and order Republicans like Lindsey Graham, whose disappointment is on a Susan Collins level, say, hey, look what we're doing here. This is this investigation was, you know, we'll hear the phrase normally used by defense lawyers to attempt to get their clients off on what we refer to as a technicality, but the fruit of the poison tree. Mm-hmm. That you can't. This evidence came from an initial illegal search, so everything that came from the illegal search is therefore poisoned. They will say that because there was this anti-Trump bias to begin with, it was unfair to begin with. That everything that emanates from that is therefore tainted with the same bias.
Yeah, yeah, which doesn't make any sense to me whatsoever.
Well, no, it doesn't make sense, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't need to make sense. It needs to have a political ring of truth and be able to hang your hat on it. And what he mostly needs to do politically is, of course, keep that core group of elected Republicans in the House and Senate strong, right?
The core defenders, you're saying.
He needs to keep the core defenders, and he needs to just not suffer breakage, because leakage, you know, when a dam starts to burst, you don't, you know, the fear is not, oh, there's a tiny little crack in the dam. You can peg that. If 1, 2, 3 crack, then the dam opens. And as soon as someone who isn't Jeff Flake, Bob Corker, Susan Collins, or Ben Sasse criticizes the president in some way, and not that these people have been such, you know.
No, they're part of the resistance. That's what I hear. But, mainly from people not in existence.
You know, I can't even think to make. Let's use someone who might not be, who says occasional things that indicate that he's not a complete lunatic. I can't believe this name should be banned as a United States senator. Senator John Kennedy from Louisiana.
Okay.
If John Kennedy says, I can't support the president. I think he may have committed a crime. That allows seven other senators to go, okay, I'm not the first. This has started. Yeah. And then he's in enormous, enormous trouble. And, of course, they want to do all they can to continue to suggest that to stave off a massive Democratic wins in the midterms and try and get this sort of sense of a miscarriage of justice against Trump to hold and stick prior to the midterms and then surprise people in the midterms and maybe even hold on the House. You see, 57% of core Trump supporters think it's impossible for Democrats to win the House, which was alarming. It was an RNC-commissioned poll that alarmed the RNC.
Impossible.
Right, because they're so disconnected from reality. But that alarms the RNC because what they need is for those supporters to think, to be motivated, as in, oh, my God, we've got to stop the red hordes from taking over the House.
You're saying that's 57%. Who don't necessarily feel like it's urgent that they vote.
I don't need to vote.
Impossible.
Right. It can't happen.
That's a good point. And just in case it hasn't been clear, like some people will hear this and they've been taught that more information is always a good thing. Well, okay, yeah, in some ways it is. But releasing this information does have some potential downsides, and that is that in terms of secret communications from, you know, Comey and all that, if they had suspicions having to do with this, if they had techniques that were revealed in these text messages, secret evidence that hasn't yet come out, those are things that are not just interesting for public viewing. They also might be important for the ongoing investigation, which is why this is another thing where, again, I'm not a lawyer, but it kind of seems like, how is this not obstruction of justice to force them to reveal all of their evidence before the investigation is done? I mean, I don't know what obstruction of justice is supposed to mean anymore. If you can do all of this, then it's totally cool.
It seems pretty clear to me that the president of the United States should recuse himself from all matters in the case involving the investigation of the president of the United States.
Yeah.
That seems incredibly obvious to me, and I'm sure there are lawyers who could make a case that this is obstruction of justice. Very hard to make an obstruction of justice case against the president of the United States.
Well, he seems to want them to have a fighting chance. We have 1 minute left. I don't want to go on at length with this, but I'm going to jump ahead to our C block. Stormy Daniels has a book coming out. Lots of books coming out recently. Lots of reading for the holiday season. It's called Full Disclosure, and it does, because she says that anytime she sees Trump on television, she thinks, I had sex with that. I'd say to myself, ugh. But then she says this, and I just leave this to linger around in your head. He has an unusual penis. It has a huge mushroom head, which he probably likes that part. Like a toadstool, I lay there annoyed that I was getting effed by a guy with Yeti pubes and a dick like the mushroom character in Mario Kart. It was unimpressive sex. Can we go to our last graphic? Because I will never again get a chance to show this on TV. But that is the analogy she's making. So enjoy that, America. Thank you for joining us for this episode of The Damage Report. Thank you, Ben, for being on the show. Thank you, Toad, for being on the show. We'll be back tomorrow morning. Thank you for listening to The Damage Report podcast, the show covering the true threats facing our country and what you can actually do about them. You can support this free podcast by leaving us a review and giving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you happen to be listening to it. Every review helps more people discover the show at no cost to you. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.